Hello, welcome to another edition of the 108 Harley Street podcast. I'm your host, Stel, and I have three co-hosts and a superb guest. First of all, let's bring in the head honcho, Johnny Wilson. How are you doing, Johnny?
I am doing absolutely fantastic, very much. So delighted to be on the podcast tonight. Very special podcast tonight, which I know you're going to introduce with the our special guest. I suppose in the middle of COVID-19, I've never been so busy in all my life. It's given me an opportunity to really kind of look and reflect on current practices, my own current practices, and as a physiotherapist and as a person, working very closely with the team down in Harley Street with regards to implementing some innovative rehabilitation programs for groin and hip pre-post surgical opportunities. So I'm really excited about that. So you're going to be hearing more about that over the coming months. And I guess I can't really say an awful lot more because I might be giving away the game on our guest tonight on the podcast.
Well, you better keep shtum then.
I will shtum it.
Taking my job here. Come on now. There's anything I could put my feet up tonight.
I am all shtummed.
Good. Right, co-host number two, all the way from Iceland. Valley, how you doing, mate?
I'm good, thanks. Honoured to be on the podcast tonight.
How you coping, mate?
I'm doing fine. So with the COVID-19, so actually starting to work in the clinic again in a few days. So it's hope it's going to be better days ahead of us. The spring is in Iceland now, so everything is getting better.
Mm. And I take it people are adhering to social distancing rules, right?
Yeah. So we're going to keep the 2 meters apart for some time and maybe some restrictions on traveling. But other than that, life will hopefully start to take the same picture again as it was before, but slowly though.
Fantastic. And the third co-host, last but not least, Steph. How you doing?
Hey, Stel. I've been well. Traveling well, working still, even though COVID-19 is still going on. Still working in the clinic. Obviously, football down here has stopped, but we're all waiting for some type of sport to start up again. So we're traveling okay for a small island country, I suppose.
So you got no sport at all down there? Nothing?
No, nothing. Apart from, I think, just horse racing is going on. But football, AFL, rugby league, everything is just, it's stopped.
Oh, so possum chasing isn't actually a sport down there?
That's just a private thing I do in my spare time still.
Okay. Fair enough. Well, I just thought it was a sport down there, you know. All those pay-per-view channels, you just never know these days, you know. But hey, there you go. Wonderful. Well, great to hear from you guys again. And we're going to introduce another returning guest to the show. It's surgical director Gilmore's groin expert. I know Johnny doesn't like using that word, but I'm going to use it anyway because I'm the host. So, it is Simon Marsh. How are you doing, Simon? You're right.
I'm all right. Good evening, everybody. I hope you're all well. Yeah, as Johnny says, it's been a difficult time. We're all learning new ways of doing things. Things have been closed down for a bit, slowly opening up again. As Steph says, and as Valley says, things are going to be opening up again soon. And 108 Harley Street is going to be back in business from the 1st of June. And we'll be back to doing all the things that we do well to try and keep people fit and make them better if they're unfit.
Fantastic. So, Johnny, lead the way, my friend.
Yes, well, I guess tonight's podcast is a very educational podcast because I'm very honoured and privileged to work with Mr. Marsh. So I get the opportunity to learn every day. So I will sometimes receive some patients who are post-surgery. I will sometimes receive some patients that Mr. Marsh might deem that could benefit from a conservative approach. So one of the patient athletes that I had today was actually one of those patient athletes who had been assessed by Mr. Marsh, and Mr. Marsh had decided that a conservative approach would work best, so not going straight for surgical management. Now, the reason why I say that is because when you give a man a hammer, all he sees are nails. So some surgeons can only see that it's just surgery is the only option. So one of the things that really kind of interested me when I was going, had the opportunity to work in Harley Street with Mr. March, was the way that they took a holistic approach, a patient-centered approach, an athlete approach, and it didn't matter how famous you are or what football club you played for, it was a case of the treatment plan had to be right for you. So what I'd like to do to ask you, Simon, just a few questions around, when you do see professional footballers and they're coming for their initial consultation, they've been referred from a professional football club, they come down, sometimes they're plus or minus their host physio. What would be the indications that a player might be a surgical candidate?
Okay, now you've already made a really important point, Johnny, that the team approach is by far the most important thing. It involves not only the surgeons, but the physios and the nurses, and if I'm going to operate anaesthetists and the hospital staff and so on, all those people are fundamentally important in getting people back to normal if they're going to need an operation. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, the first thing you need to know is to make sure you've got a person who's definitely got, and I'm going to use the phrase as well, Gilmore's groin. Now, the reason I still use Gilmore's groin is everybody knows what I mean by that. It's a specific syndrome of groin pain within a whole load of things that can cause groin pain. So the first thing you've got to do is make sure that you've got the right diagnosis. If you operate on the wrong people, they're not going to get better. And as we've discussed before, it's that specific set of symptoms in footballers. And the classic sort of pattern is that they play and after a game they're stiff and sore for a couple of days, but they just about recover by midweek so they can train. Then they're sore again, but they can play at the weekend. And then it takes them a whole week to recover. And then they start getting pain during the game and they start coming off typically about 20 minutes before the end, and then they just can't play. And they get pain when they're kicking or sprinting or pushing off goalkeepers if they're dead ball kicking. And all these things go together, and typically you get stiff and sore, as I say, for a few days after the pain. So that's the first thing you've got to do, is make sure you've got the right set of symptoms. And then you've got to do the famous Gilmore examination, where you have to examine this thing called the inguinal canal, which is sort of just above your groin. And the only way to get there, I'm afraid, is to stick your little finger up inside the scrotum. I'm not sure if I can say scrotum, but I've said it anyway. To feel this inguinal ring, which gets pulled apart, then you get the pain where the muscles are torn. And you mentioned very kindly the Marsh diagnostic jigsaw that we use. And the third step of that, apart from listening to the symptoms and getting the signs, is these days is getting the MRI scan. And you've got to have an MRI scan done and reported by a radiologist, so an X-ray specialist who knows what they're looking for. Because classically, I get people who come with an MRI scan, they set up MRI scan, it's normal. And I send it off to Dr. Jalan, who works with us in 108 Harley Street. And she will say it isn't normal at all. And in 80% of cases, you can see changes that fit with the Gilmore's groin, the torn groin. It's a tear of the muscles and the tendons in the groin. So it's not a hernia, there's no lump, there's nothing poking through, but it's a tear of the muscles and tendons in the groin. So that's the most important thing first, is to make sure you're dealing with this specific set of symptoms and signs within the whole lot of things that can cause groin pain, be it hip or adductor or psoas, abdominal tears, all those things that can cause groin pain. You've got this specific syndrome within that set. So that's the first thing. The second thing is whether, as you suggest, they've tried any sort of rehabilitation before. And ideally, you would do that first. Now, I spend a lot of my time operating, but I spend more time not operating on people because I do try not to operate, because often you can get them better. There is, of course, with professional footballers where time is money, and if they're not playing, they're losing money, then they're going to want an operation sooner rather than later. And it's interesting, when Jerry Gilmore started doing all this back in the 80s, in the first 3 years, the time between the onset of symptoms and referral to him on average is about 15 weeks. In the next 4 years, it came down to 6 weeks. And now we're seeing people, you know, within a week or two now of getting a groin injury. So it's interesting how, as people become aware of the syndrome, they get referred sooner and sooner. But really, what you're looking for in professionals, if conservative treatment hasn't worked, if you're going to operate, you're looking at Are they unable to train so they can't play? And you'll find they're losing speed and they're losing fitness. So all this, all these things are happening. Then you're thinking, okay, and you've got the right set of symptom signs. That's when you're thinking about an operation. Now, for amateurs, it's different. And you're going to be slightly more relaxed about it. But if the pain is affecting their everyday life, or they enjoy their sport so much they just can't do it, and their quality of life is poor because of that, then again, you're going to think about an operation. So it's slightly different for professionals and for amateurs. And certainly for amateurs, we would want a proper period of attempted conservative rehab before you go for an operation.
Lovely. Okay, right. Well, thank you very much for that, Simon. There are many surgical procedures, and I was just wondering, what type of a procedure do you prefer?
Okay, now this is actually very straightforward, but you're right. People do all sorts of things. They put meshes in, they do laparoscopic repairs and so on. But what you've got to remember is this is a tear of the muscles and tendons in the front of the abdomen, in the groin. So if you do a laparoscopic operation and you approach it from behind, you cannot see the tears. And if you stick a big plastic patch on the inside of the abdomen, you are not repairing the tears in the muscles and tendons at all. It does not help. What it might do is stiffen the groin a bit, which can affect your hip extension and your speed and your sprinting, but you're not actually repairing muscles. So if you accept, I think almost everybody does, that this is a tear of the muscles and tendons in the groin, the only logical thing to do is approach it from the front with a scar at the front. Now, you can do it through a relatively small scar. It can be 4 or 5 centimetres. And you can go through each layer of the muscles. You can look at the external oblique and the internal oblique and the conjoint tendon. You can see the back wall of the inguinal canal. And so you can see the tears, you can see the disruptions, and you repair each layer and you put the anatomy of the groin back together again. Because what's basically happened is the muscles and tendons have torn off, so they're not in the right place. And if muscles and tendons tear off, they can't work properly because they're not anchored properly. And sticking a plastic patch over torn muscles and tendons leaves you with a plastic patch over torn muscles and tendons, which still don't work. So the only logical way to do it is to fix it with stitches that will all eventually dissolve anatomically. And throw the patches out the window, please.
So what is the most common anatomy that you find when you go in for surgery that has been torn or damaged and that you're repairing? So what exact anatomy are you repairing?
Okay, so the first thing you'll see, so when you do the operation, you go through the skin, there's always a bit of fat under the skin. Now, in professional athletes, there isn't much of that, and I have to say, they are, they're a joy to operate on, these guys and girls, because they've got very little fat. Makes it much easier, unlike people like me. And the first thing you see is this structure called the external oblique aponeurosis. Now, an aponeurosis is a flat tendon. So if you imagine a tendon and hit it with a mallet, it flattens out and you get this flat sheet. And you will find tears in that, or it's stretched. So instead of being a nice, shiny, white sheet, it's what we call attenuated. It's very thin, or it's got actual tears in it. So that's the first bit you see. And what you do, you actually divide that and you lift it up and get underneath it. And then you can see the internal oblique muscle, and you'll find that's torn off the inguinal ligament. Now, the inguinal ligament runs from two bony points. There's one called the anterior superior iliac spine up on your pelvis towards your side. The other is towards the middle on the pubic bone, the pubic tubercle. And the inguinal ligament runs between those two and supports all the groin muscles. And the internal oblique muscle gets pulled off that, so that needs to go back onto it. And underneath the internal oblique muscle is a third layer called the transversalis muscle. And because that's not supported by the internal oblique muscle, which has been pulled away, that inner layer gets very soft and flabby, and it gets very loose. So what you have to do is tighten up that back layer, what we call plicated, to tighten it up, put the middle layer back on the inguinal ligament, and then tighten up the external oblique. Now, there's one extra bit we do as well. As the inguinal ligament goes onto pubic tubercle and get really tight, and you just release that inguinal ligament on the pubic tubercle, which allows it to move back about 0.5 centimetre. It takes all the tension off the pelvis. Because one of the problems people get is this sort of pubic bone stress syndrome that goes with it. It used to be called osteitis pubis, but a better term is probably pubic bone stress injury. And if you take the stress off the pelvis, you also help reduce the pain and get people back to playing sport more quickly. So it's looking at each layer and fixing each layer as you go.
So one of the most common things that you will hear, common things are common, and you will hear a lot of patients or a lot of footballers, I should say in particular, given my own background, and the moment they experience groin pain, there seems to be an almost pack mentality of you've got a hernia. And it's their diagnosis, it's their preferred diagnosis, it's the diagnosis of choice. When they go and ask their teammates inside in the dressing room, they've all diagnosed with absolute certainty a hernia. And then the player will enter the medical room 15 minutes later with a definitive diagnosis, a prognosis of a return to play and performance within 2 weeks, and they will have two preferred surgeons. Is there any reason why players and so on and so forth come up with this diagnosis almost immediately? The moment they clutch or they feel any kind of signs or symptoms or pain around the groin, they think they've got a hernia. And are hernias that common?
The reason they say they think they've got a hernia is because that's what people relate to getting pain in the groin. But as we said, in a hernia, there's a hole in the muscles where your innards come out, so it's usually a bit of fatty stuff or sometimes your intestine. These guys don't have a hernia. It's a fine distinction for the public. It's a very definite distinction medically in that there is no hernia in these people, but that's what people call it, and it's commonly called a sportsman's hernia. Now, I don't mind if that's what people are happy calling it, but it's not technically a hernia, so you don't fix it like a hernia. You have to fix it like torn muscles and tendons. That's the difference. The difficulty is, as you say, that there are lots of things that can cause pain in that area. And a lot of people relate adductor problems to hernias. And, of course, adductor problems are slightly further down on the inside of the thighs. It goes up into the pelvis. But it's interesting how a lot of sportsmen, when you mention the groin, they will say it's the adductor. Whereas medically and surgically, the groin is higher up. It's above the crease in the hip. And it's in the lower abdomen. So there are, if you like, confusions medically and in popular parlance about which bit is which and what causes the pain. But it's not a hernia. I think the reason that people try and fix it with a mesh is that that's how you can fix hernias. But these guys do not have hernias. They don't have a lump. They have torn muscles and tendons. So you've got to fix it properly, otherwise it won't work.
So again, just to help dispel our myth burst here, okay, how frequent is a true hernia where you will get a propagation of the innards, so the abdominal contents through the abdominal muscles in professional footballers? So if you were to operate on 100 professional footballers, out of those, how many would have a true hernia?
Probably one or two.
One or two.
Because I can only think of one or two, actually, that I've done proper hernias on.
Okay, so that is a huge myth buster there, because again, I would say only one or two out of those about 100 would think that they didn't have a hernia.
Yes.
So you know, you can see really where the controversy comes there for sure. Now, if somebody has come to you pretty early, and they have been diagnosed with they've got the correct diagnosis, okay. The taxonomy around groin pain is huge. I think we're past 45 diagnostic terms now for pain, signs and symptoms, pain around that area, around the groin area. So if somebody gets the correct diagnosis from you and they are a surgical candidate and they do need repair of the anatomy that we've just spoken about, a return to training, a return to play, a return to performance, sort of prognosis, what would it likely be? Let's say without any complications.
So I think you're looking at 4 to 6 weeks. And what you have to remember is if you're fixing torn muscles and tendons, they've got to heal. And you've mentioned that people think they'll be back in 2 weeks. Now, the only thing that heals in 2 weeks in this operation is the skin. And if you look at any physiology textbook and look at healing times, you'll see that muscles and tendons don't heal in 2 weeks. They take 4 weeks. Now, we've had people back in under 4 weeks and one side done. I think my best one is a chap who was, he did triathlons and he was competing in the world triathlons in Brazil 6 weeks after having both sides done. Now, that's pretty exceptional, I think. And I would much rather that people took a little longer, did all the proper rehab and physio they're supposed to get everything strong before they go back to play, rather than get caught up in the, oh, I can go back in 2 weeks and actually do more harm than good and be out potentially for much longer.
So that what you've segued on very nicely onto my next question. So an incomplete rehabilitation phase or rushing a return to training, play, competition or performance, what are the potential consequences of going back into competition or training or playing too early?
I think one of the things that's important after, once you've had a groin disruption, once you get it, the muscles actually weaken pretty quickly. So as well as repairing the muscles, the other muscles, so the adductor muscles, the thigh muscles, will weaken really quickly. And it takes a while to build those back up again. So if you're rushing back into training and playing and your muscles aren't quite back to where they were, you risk actually all sorts of other injuries. Not so much a recurrent groin disruption, because though I say so myself, I'm quite a good surgeon, a good stitcher, so it doesn't fall apart that often. We have over 40-odd years, we see 3% of people in a 10-year period do it again. So it's not very common. But what you risk are hamstring injuries, you risk abdominal injuries, you risk quads injuries and so on. That's what you risk. And also you risk doing it on the other side. If you're favouring one side, you risk causing damage the other side as well. And again, we know from all our data that 10% of people over a 10-year period will do the other side, which actually means 90% don't, which is good, but 10% do. But it's putting yourself at risk of actually a lot of other injuries because you've not got your muscles back to full fitness before you play again.
Is there, thank you for that, that's an excellent answer. Is there a role for any other type of invasive procedures, i.e. injections? Is that, you know, do you see a role for injection therapy around the groin? Is this a strategy that you might use to, I would say, prolong the period that the player is in training and playing? Maybe it's coming up to an important competition. Maybe there's, at the end of the season, there can be various cases.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, injections in the adductor can work quite well. That does it. It stuns the nerve in the groin. So although it doesn't heal the muscles, it stops it hurting. So you can play on for a bit longer. Now, the issue with that is if you're playing on through pain that you don't know you've got, are you actually going to do more damage? That's the issue. But we did use that occasionally, and it worked very well to buy us a few weeks if people had a really important game.
That was my next question on that. So thank you for taking that, for answering
it's
that.
It's the ESP. We've worked together too long, Johnny. We know what we're thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. So with regards to a time frame, then I think that 4 to 6 weeks is, you know, I would say a very authentic answer. I would say a reasonable answer. I would say from a physiotherapist working with a surgeon, it gives everybody an opportunity to recover, to implement meaningful strategies for the player to start developing a systems approach. So building up their aerobic, anaerobic strength, power profiles, you know, getting them ready to tolerate the demands of their sport again. So I think that's really important. And as regards, I was intrigued with regards to the anatomy and how your approach to surgery as well. Now, I know yourself and Mr. Gilmore have operated on a huge amount of professional athletes. Without breaking patient confidentiality, I don't know if you'd be able to answer this question. Could you maybe give us an example of a case that he did with a famous player, or I don't know?
That's really hard, Johnny, unfortunately. That's very difficult. I mean, you know, the figures are now over 9,000 cases, 500 internationals, and so on. It's difficult to pin down one. I mean, on the website, there are pictures of people that have been operated upon, and if people want to go and look, they can see the photographs and judge for themselves the success. But it's probably not fair to pick a particular person. Sorry, you're quite right. We just need to be proper about that.
And advances in groin surgery over the next 10 years, any type of thoughts on that?
I think the scans will get better. I mean, when MRI scans got better, and particularly with 3T MRI scanners, that was quite revolutionary in making sure you've got a test of imaging that will give you an answer. And 80% of the time, you can see the changes if you get the right radiologist to look at it. And I think that will continue to improve. One of the things I'm working on with the imaging team we work with is 3D MRI scans. Now, people are aware that with CT scans, you can get 3D pictures. And you can do the same with MRI scans, but the software is really quite complicated. And you could do CT scans of people's groins, but the X-ray dose of that is really quite high. And it's difficult to justify that in a fit sports person, giving them a really high dose of X-rays when you can get the same information from an MRI scan. But the ability to look at a 3D picture and rotate it around and actually show people what you're looking at, that will be something. And we're working quite hard on that, but it's not easy. In terms of the surgery, one of the things that's always troubled me is that the surgeons coming through now, it seems to me, have lost the understanding of the anatomy of the groin. Because they've all been trained just to slap plastic patches on things, they don't think about the tension or the origins or the insertions of muscles and tendons. They just slap a patch over it. And that bothers me, that we may, a bit like, you know, nobody can make a Stradivarius violin anymore because we don't know how to do it. It bothers me that in future people will just lose the understanding of the anatomy of the groin and will not be able to do a proper Gilmore's groin anatomical sutured repair. So that's a concern. So we're looking for people to join us in the clinic who we know can operate properly and understand the anatomy in order to take things further.
My last question for you, Mr. Marsh. Our audience will be, the majority of our audience will be semi-professional or amateur footballers who might not have the support and scaffold that professional footballers do, i.e. they might not have their own physiotherapist or access to a sports medicine team. So for those soccer players, those footballers who don't have a physiotherapist or somebody that they can access, what would the typical signs and symptoms be that might indicate that somebody's got a sportsman's groin?
Yeah, it's similar to the things we mentioned. There are two sets of symptoms. There are pain and the symptoms you get during sport and the symptoms afterwards. So after you've played, you get the pain and stiffness. You might get pain with coughing and sneezing. And typically people get pain from getting up from a low position, so getting out of bed or getting out of their car. And obviously when they're playing, they get the pain usually in the lower abdomen, so in the surgical inguinal region, in the surgical groin rather than the adductor groin. If they're kicking, sprinting, twisting, turning particularly, but of course adductor problems can cause that, and there are some other things that cause that too. But that's the sort of pattern you're looking for. Again, you've brought up the fact how important the team is. And I think for the amateurs, we also need to be realistic about the return to play time. And it's going to be longer than 4 to 6 weeks and possibly 6 to 12 weeks for the amateurs who don't have, first of all, the fitness that the professionals have, because there is a significant difference in how fit professional footballers are compared with amateurs. It's really significant. And one of the things, you know, we've been doing, and the reason that, you know, you've been working with us, is that we're building a program that puts physiotherapy with you and your team automatically, not only into the recovery period after surgery, but also before surgery. So sort of a prehab before surgery and then surgery in the rehab. So the physiotherapy becomes an automatic part of the recovery. Because actually the surgery is relatively straightforward. The hard part is what you guys do. It's getting people back to fitness again after I've left them with a scar and a bit of pain.
Thank you so much for that, by the way.
I just tell you how it is, Johnny. That's all I do.
Absolutely. Mr. Marsh, if anybody listening to the podcast would like to get in touch with you, maybe they've got the what you've just explained there regards to signs and symptoms. And we are in COVID-19 period at the moment. Is there an opportunity for people to reach out?
There is. I mean, all the details on the website, so 108harleystreet.co.uk. Now, as we said, we're opening up fully again on the 1st of June, and we're preparing for that now. We can do phone calls. We can still do phone call consultations. The difficulty with that is you really do need to examine somebody with this to see exactly what they've got. But as I say, it's actually not going to be that long before we're open to everybody again, being it, you know, as you say, ordinary hernias or the groin strains or whatever. We'll soon be back in business again, sorting people out properly. So if people out there have got what they think is a Gilmore's groin, a groin disruption, hernia, whatever, you can get in touch via the website. We can make an appointment for June. We're back on the 1st of June. We'll see you and we'll see if we can't sort you out.
And I'm sure there'll be a tsunami of demand once soccer is... I guess nobody's getting injured at the moment anyway. Nobody's playing any soccer, so, you know.
Yeah, and what we'll probably find is as soon as they go back, because a lot of people lost fitness, we're going to get a lot of groin problems. So yeah, everybody out there, be careful when you go back to sport. You'll need to build up again carefully. If you don't, I'll see you in clinic.
Brilliant. I'm going to hand over to the team to ask a few questions. Steph, would you like to ask Simon any questions?
Yeah, I would. That was all really quite an interesting insight there, Mr. Marsh. I do have a quick question about return to play. So how important to you, do you have a certain expectation, whether it be from yourself or from the medical team at the club, whether it be at an amateur level or a professional level, on how their rehab is guided? Is it sort of like a half-half approach, or are you quite heavily involved in the do's and don'ts guiding that rehab forward?
For the professional guys who've got their own physios, what tends to happen is the physios will come along, and often I'll get them in to watch the operation as well, so they can see exactly what's gone on. And then I'm normally quite content to leave it with the professional physios in the team. That's okay. They know what we do. They've seen it. We do have a standard sort of physio protocol, which they can have. But obviously, it's going to be player dependent, and it'll depend on what position they play and so on. And usually, I'm delighted to say, we do that. They go back to physio. And the majority of these guys I never see again because they're fine, which is great. Now, they have access to their phone numbers and so on, so they can always phone up. One or two like to come back just to be sure they're okay, and usually we get them back in a month, because by that time you can tell everything's healed properly, and then they know they can get back into full training for the next week or two before they go back to play. For the amateurs, as I say, it's more difficult when they don't have physio, and this is where you and Johnny and all the rest of the physios come in. And as I say, we're building a program that means that they will get physiotherapy as part of their treatment, and I think that's really important, rather than just doing an operation and sending them home with a sheet of exercises to do.
Yeah,
I think it's important they get assessed and guided to make sure they're recovering properly. It's a really important part of the whole treatment.
Okay. Yeah.
Any more from you, Steph?
No, not for now. Or actually, maybe just thinking about characters that you've come across, and how does that vary your approach in how you explain possibly what goes on in the surgery, like if you have a player that's maybe overthinking or a bit hesitant going into the surgery, or one that just wants to get it done but might not need to get it done. Does your approach really differ, or how do you sort of combat that?
Yeah, I think it's probably fairly similar. I mean, I tend to explain things in a relatively simple way, and again, we've got an information sheet you can get on the website that talks through things in the same three layers of the muscles that we talked about. And you're right, I don't suppose anybody really wants an operation. I've had a couple of fairly big ones in my time, and I didn't particularly want either of them. I didn't have much choice. And in the end, it's fine, but nobody really wants an operation because it's a bit sore. It hurts for a few days. I make no bones about that. I think a lot of the professionals, when they know that's what they've got, they want it done and fixed so they can move on. That's fine. Some are reluctant, and you know, in that situation, what I will say is that we'll go away and play and see what happens. And I think you're probably going to find you can't, because you've had a bit of rest, you've had a bit of physio. And if it still hurts and you can't play, then actually, you know, you've got no choice. So one of the things to do is go away and tell them to push it really hard. And they very quickly phone up and say, actually, I'll have it done now. That's fine.
Okay.
I think for the amateurs, it's really important that they've had a proper period of physio and rehab. So we've exhausted every other option before we go to surgery for them.
Fantastic. Okay. Vali, have you any questions, being a head physiotherapist at Reykjavik in Iceland? Anything that maybe you've got a couple of players who have got groin pain at the moment. Is there anything that you'd like to discuss with Mr. Marsh?
I felt a really interesting talk, and I think Iceland being semi-professional or amateur, the time frame in Iceland is that we usually have quite a lot of conservative management before surgery, as we are trying to get hold of specialists to have a look, orthopedic surgeons and others. So we have a lot of time to strengthen players and see if they can make it or not. So sometimes I just tell players if they're scared to do something, I would say we make it or break it almost. But Simon, have you seen any indication that, like, if a player will play on and train on with pain for a longer period of time, that he will take longer to return to play after a surgery if he has one?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I can't quantify that, but my impression is that the longer somebody has gone on with it, the longer it takes them to recover. In the same way that when I started doing this 20-odd years ago with the late Jerry Gilmore, we sort of had an unspoken rule that we didn't operate on anybody over 45, because they didn't really get it. And then as people got fitter for longer, you're operating on people who are less young. And the other thing I find is the less young you are and they've done, the longer it takes you to get better. The exception to that is a few years ago, a chap in his 70s came to see me. He was a retired professional tennis player and said, he just walked in and said, I've got Gilmore's groin, I want the operation. And I said, well, hang on, you know, you're 76, you know, it's just time to slow down. He said, but I play tennis 3 times a week and I can't play and I want the operation. I've got the groin. So I asked him the questions. I examined him. He said, I've got the groin, haven't I? I said, well, yeah, you have. He said, I want the operation. So I rather reluctantly said, okay. So I operated on a fixed groin. A month later, he came back to see him for his checkup. And somewhat tentatively, I said, you know, how are you doing? He said, great. I played tennis last week. No problem. Thanks very much. So I don't have an age limit now. It all goes on the fitness and the symptoms and the signs. But in general, I think you're right. The longer you've had it, the more chronic it is. And the less young you are, the longer it takes to recover fully.
Fantastic. Valley, any other questions?
No, I don't think so at the moment, thanks.
Brilliant. So I will hand over to our Master of Ceremonies, Stel. Mr. Marsh, that was absolutely enlightening, and I'm sure loads of people will get so much from that. Thank you very much from me anyway.
No, thank you. I hope so. And if people need more information, they know where we are.
Perfect.
Simon, I've got a question.
Go on, Stel, go on.
Okay, so I'll give you a quick story. A few years ago, well, more than a few years ago, I was on a holiday, and I went out with my cousin, was in Cyprus, and his car broke down. Ended up going to the mechanics. They've opened the hood, and 4 or 5 of them circled around the car like sharks, and they were looking around and saying, oh, I've never seen anything like this before, obviously in Greek. Have you ever performed surgery, and as you were about to start, you looked at you like, crikey, this is a nasty one?
In terms of groins, you know, it's often quite different because the different layers are torn to a different extent. I can remember one or two where you're surprised at just how frayed and torn all the muscles actually are. And you just think, oh, I can really see why this guy's had pain. Most of them, I have to say, fit a fairly standard pattern because it's a fairly well-defined syndrome. But you do find the one or two that you just look and you think, oh, my God, how has this bloke's leg ever stayed on? You know, everything's completely fallen apart. And I think those will take longer. The one or two I've said, you've got to be really careful after this. We're going to take it really slowly because it was so badly torn. And I do score the groins on a scale of 12, funnily enough, because you look at the four layers, the four main layers, and you can grade each one as a mild, moderate, or severely torn, so 1, 2, or 3. So the maximum you can get is a tear of 12, which would be really bad. I've given a couple of 11s, but most people are 10, 9s, 8s. But I've never actually given a 12 to anybody, but I've given a couple of 11s, and those are the ones you remember, because you just think, my God, how does this groin ever work in the first place?
Mm. Fantastic. Well, I've got one more question, and again, back to the car analogy. Sorry about that. You go to a mechanic, you get your car sorted, it packs in. A few weeks later, you go to another mechanic, and that mechanic says to you, crikey, who did this one? Have you ever had this situation before?
yeah, and I can't say who. But it was not a footballer, but a rugby footballer who had done his groin and had had an operation for his groin elsewhere, somewhere further north. And he just had all the right signs and symptoms. I went to do it again. And when I went into it again, I couldn't find any signs that he'd had any sort of operation before. No scarring, no stitching, nothing. And I did come away thinking, well, what on earth has he had done or not previously? And if he hasn't had much done before, that would explain why his groin still doesn't work. But I do remember that one very well because it was just such a surprise. Because normally when somebody has an operation before, and you go back in, they're scarring, their things called adhesions and so on, it's very obvious. But there was nothing in this chap at all. And that's the only time I've ever thought, has he really had anything done? He had a scar in his groin, but that was all. And that did surprise me.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Cheers.
No problem.
Fantastic. Absolute brilliant insight into indications for surgical management, return to play, complications, when it goes right, the importance of the team looking at pre-surgery strength and conditioning, looking at from baseline point of view as well. Age is no excuse, and looking at person's occupation, so which is a very, very empowering aspect. So brilliant. So I guess it's on to the next part of our podcast tonight, Harley Street Podcast. And it is a very exciting part because we're on to the next chapter of Francie and Pepper's amazing hernia journey. So I think I'd love to get your opinion at the end of this, if that's okay, Mr. Marsh. If you've got 20 minutes to stay on the podcast with us.
No, for you, Johnny, anything at all, you know that.
Fantastic. Well, we have the two authors tonight of tonight's chapter, which is going to be dropped on 108 SEM over the next 2 days. So we have Paulina Chabatska and Vali Valgier. And they are going to talk to us about their chapter. Maybe, Vali, would you give us a bit of a brief, or in fact, what I'll do is I'll set the scene, and then we'll go on to chapter 3.
You might want to give a quick recap of the previous...
Yes, yeah. I will set the scene, and then I will come on to you, Stel, so that you can say a little bit about your chapter, because you and Ben Dinnery and myself, we authored the last chapter, which was a hashtag banger of a chapter, mm-hmm. I must say, because obviously I was involved in it, of course, for the listeners. So this is the great adventure of Francie McGrine and Pepper Watson. And Francie McGrine is a 17-year-old footballer, and he's on his second year scholarship at a professional football club. And he's travelled over from Northern Ireland. And there's a reason for that, and you'll find out about that in Chapter 9. And Francie is one of those diligent players. He's done his first year as a scholar. He's done okay. He's not the best player in the squad. He's not the worst player either, but he works really hard. So in the off-season, he's been doing two-a-days. Two-a-days are when you train twice a day. So he's been working really hard on his fitness levels. He's super fit, super strong, and he's back on first day of pre-season. First day of pre-season, he's at the front of all the runs. He's doing really well. And it comes towards the end of the session, and there's some crossing and finishing. He's gone to cross in a ball, and then he's felt this sudden, sharp sensation in his groin, down around his adductors. So Francie clutched his groin and immediately thought he had a hernia. Now, Pepper Watson, she is a young physiotherapist, 24 years of age. She's been 2 years in the NHS. And her dream has always been to work in professional football. In fact, she wants to be the first female head of sports medicine at Manchester United. That's her dream. Francie's dream is to play for Manchester United. So these two don't know what their dreams are at the moment, but they're intertwined. Anyway, Francie has got to now. He's very worried. He's got 10 months before it's either make or break time before he gets a professional contract. And all of a sudden, he feels like his dream is shattered because he thinks he's got a hernia. As he's making his way to Pepper on the first day of pre-season, her first day on the job as well, he is absconded by some of his teammates who tell him that you definitely got a hernia, you definitely need to go and see Mr. Marsh, and you'll be back within 2 weeks. So Francie then approaches Pepper, and before Pepper could even say hello, Francie, you know, Francie had said, look, I think I've got a hernia, I need an external consultation here, I kind of know who I want to see. And poor old Pepper, you know, she took a deep breath. She's one of those real stoic characters, you know. She's just one that you would love to call a friend. So she said, look, I'll see you in the treatment room. And you know the way treatment rooms go, players are milling in and out, they're checking on your welfare, and they want to know what it is, and they're shouting out, is it a hernia, isn't it a hernia? And you can imagine being the first day on the job. It's your first day in your dream job as a physiotherapist in professional football, and you've got all these players coming in and out of the medical room. There is no patient confidentiality. And poor old Pepper, she panics a little bit and doesn't carry out a thorough subjective. And what I mean by subjective is she doesn't ask questions about the quality of the pain, the signs, the symptoms, the mechanism of injury. Has he had any previous injury before? You know, and then she's gone straight into a physical examination. And Francie is testing 12 out of 10 for every single exam that she goes. So, you know, she's none the wiser. So she looked at Francie. Francie's got some ice in his groin. The lads are going home. Francie's feeling sorry for himself. He's like, you know, bloody hell, you know. And she's looking at him. She's like, going, do you know what? You probably need to go home now. And this is where Stel is going to come in and give us a little bit of backdrop to the chapter, his chapter, so that we're setting the scene for Paulina and Valley's chapter. Stel, take it away.
Yeah, well, Pepper's got no information whatsoever. She's done a hatchet job, pretty much. and she's about to approach the gaffer. She's only spoken to him once, and that was the interview. So she's knocked on the door, she's gone in, and straight away she looks at the room, and it's a very intimidating room. She sees posters of the manager, but with other greats like your Beckenbauers, like your Fergusons, and already she knows that this guy means business. And you know, in Scooby-Doo, when Scooby-Doo shits himself and he jumps on Shaggy whenever he sees a ghost, that's the feeling that she gets. She's petrified. And the gaffer has absolutely torn into her because she's got no explanation, absolutely no information for him. And he just, how can I put it? He tears her a new one, so to speak. But Pepper walks out and she thinks that her world is about to end. And then she bumps into a kit man that's very, very nice. And he reassures her that everything's going to be A-OK eventually. And it's a massive learning curve for her. So that's a nice way I can put it, really.
Cool.
Have I missed anything, Johnny?
Well, the reason why she... Well, Kev turned up at the Kev the Kitman turned up at the right time because the gaffer...
Knight in shining armour.
Yeah, you know, there was a bit going on there, and Pepper, in the midst of her panic, hadn't taken any contact details for Francie either, and the gaffer wanted to have a chat with Francie. But unfortunately, Pepper had sent him home at the same time as the healthy players. So Francie was nowhere to be seen. The gaffer is gone apoplectic at this stage. And that brings us on to Paulina and Valley's chapter. Now, Paulina and Valley, before you start this, I should tell you that I'm going to go into ruthless mode now. Okay? So we're going to see what your chapter is all about. And if I can pick holes in your chapter for people to kind of read, then, you know, it's going to happen now. So tell us a little bit about what people can expect in this chapter. Maybe, Paulina, if you start off with in your chapter, maybe if you introduce yourself first, Paulina, and then tell us a little bit about what people can expect to read in your chapter.
Hi, guys. Really happy to join you here today. And I thought all of this stuff that we were talking about before is very interesting and making insights that you've provided. So my name is Paulina Trubatska, myself and Valley, we've wrote a chapter 4 of our Francie's adventures. So in chapter 4, we really focus on developing some character for both Francie and Pepper. And as Johnny and Stella mentioned, Francie has been allowed to go home with the rest of the group. And now Pepper is desperate trying to get hold of him. So he doesn't answer for him for a while. But then he actually does call her back and he's on his way back to the club. He's not very happy about it, but you know, he'll come back because he knows that Gaff wants to keep him, so he's just rushing back to the club. And you know, on the way back or when he returned back, he's going straight into the Gaffer because he just wants to, well, set things right and basically just, you know, it was fault. He's there. What is all this about? Why am I getting called up? And then it just develops into a little conversation between two of them, where Francie does tell his secret. Obviously, I'm giving you all an overview, so I'm not going to go into too much detail on that just yet. And then Francie returns back to Pepper after having a conversation with the gaffer. Francie was looking for help in Pepper after putting a brave face into the situation. So, you know, immediately as he enters the manager's office, he's trying to, you know, to look as if he's actually fit to play. He all wants right. to look like he's ready.
I'm going to stop you there, Paulina. Okay?
Yeah, go on.
Right. And I'm going to ask Steph and Vali to give us possible scenarios of what could happen in this chapter. Just possible scenarios. I don't want to know exactly what the storyline is going to go. But so Francie has come back into to the club. He's not happy, as Paulina has said. And the gaffer wants him back there. The gaffer is not happy. I'm not too sure myself because, you know, it's day one. Injuries happen. Francie was at the front of the runs. Why should the gaffer, you know, be angry? Why should the gaffer call him back? Does the gaffer have any real right at all to call a player back because he's injured or because an injured player should stay, you know, should be the first one in and the last to go because they're injured? That doesn't sound very fair to me at all. In fact, you know, as in you're punishing somebody who's tried their hardest in the off-season and then ended up getting injured. Surely this is an unreasonable expectation of the manager. Steph.
Yes, but does Francie want to become a professional or not? That's what I say, Johnny. I think, look, it is a hard approach from the gaffer, but, you know, if he's in there, he's got to put in the hard yards. And I suppose him walking in there, seeing Pepper, an unfamiliar face, she's having to build that rapport with him. I guess he's just gone and made his own decision up and started guiding his own rehab straight off the bat. Was made up his decision straight off the bat. So, I don't know. I'm on the fence at the moment. So far, about.
You're standing up for the gaffer here. You think that the manager is well within his right to call back a player because he's injured. And that player should have to stay longer than everybody else because he has put his body on the line. Every time you're at training and you're asking your players to go eyeballs out, you're asking your players to do everything they can to either win in a training game or win in a competitive game, and that player does exactly what you ask of him, and he or she then gets injured. And then you go back to the player and you tell them, right, injured players, you're going to get punished. You'll be first in and you'll be last out. I'm not sure myself.
I wouldn't take it as a punishment approach, though, Johnny. We got to wrap him in a little bit of cotton wool and let him know that, all right, you've worked hard, you're in this position now, you're injured. Now we've just got to get back on the horse and work hard, but in a modified way. Tone it down a little bit, get your rehab underway, get your diagnosis down pat and start working hard in that way. I think as well, for a younger player, it sets maybe a good expectation of even though you've worked hard, you've done as much as you could in the off season to get yourself fit and ready. These things happen, and this is what we've got to do to keep moving forward.
Okay, well, thank you so much for that answer, Steph, and bringing some nice reasonable thought to the show. Vali, is there any excuse for Pepper's lackluster, poor, subjective? Is it defendable to say, you know what, it was my first day on the job and I just didn't, you know, and that's my defense. I didn't carry out a good subjective because I was under a lot of pressure. There was players milling in and out of the room. They were asking him, was he okay? He thought he had a hernia. He wasn't very compliant. He wasn't giving me very good answers. And that's why I went into my physical examination. Is there ever an excuse for that?
I would like to say no, but I think when you're new in the dressing room and new with the club, you're trying to build a relationship with the player and maybe the player doesn't trust you enough to give you all the information, or you just need to know how to communicate with the player. So if the player is not actually responding and giving any information, how long are you going to spend on trying to get this objective? Or are you just going to do a bit of physical examination and then try to add on to this objective? So no, I would like to, I would have liked for her to done a proper subjective examination, but having had players that almost miss the, well, some players even just are unable to speak when they get injured on the field when you run on, you're not going to spend too much time doing subjective, so you have to do something. So I think that's why she probably jumped into the physical examination.
Now, you see, I've got a little bit of an issue here, right? Because she's brought her A game to her interview. She's in the gaffer and she's performing. She's got her answers right. She's telling the gaffer this, she's telling the gaffer that. And then on the first day, the first injury, it's hardly rocket science. You know, it's not as if she didn't, there was an unreasonable expectation of players coming in and out. She didn't manage the medical room very well. She didn't manage the other players very well. She couldn't even carry out a subjective after working 2 years in the NHS. I'm not sure if I could defend that.
No, I think I would agree with you, but I think that the pressure when you're in the dressing room, in the medical room, it can be a lot, because many players talking, he's probably upset. The player's upset being injured and seeing his hopes and dreams maybe fade out. He's afraid he needs to have a surgery. So I think the pressure as well on her is a bit more in the dressing room, because it's Francie definitely wants to play the next game.
Okay. Listen, thank you so much for that. Steph?
That's an interesting point. Like the NHS side of it, I feel, is an interesting point or interesting background that Pepper has, because I feel it would be such a different approach to coming into a sporting environment compared to hospital system. I feel that going into the job, she would have maybe revised over, you know, anatomy and maybe youth player injuries, common injuries, but maybe she didn't dive into how to perform a subjective on these types of individuals and how it may differ to the hospital system. So I suppose in that way she was having to learn on her feet, and possibly something she never thought about.
Yes, there's a lot to be said about industrial knowledge and industrial examination. So I go back to Valley's point. So what I do on the first day of pre-season with all the players is, and this is pre-organized or pre-agreed with the management staff, is that I will sit down to them and talk about what I do when I run out onto the pitch. So if I run out onto the pitch and you're not communicating with me, you're coming off because I'm suspecting you've got a concussion and you're not behaving like you would normally behave, even if you are clutching your ankle. If I come onto the pitch and you are not telling me what your signs or symptoms are, or if I ask you, are you able to continue, and you don't give me an answer, a definitive answer, an answer that I can relay back to the dugout, you're coming off. And very, very quickly, players realise that when you come out onto that pitch, that there is an expectation of them to communicate very clearly with you, as there are players that have to be warming up, and that is a team approach here. Now, I obviously say it a lot nicer, and I discuss the implications of, you know, how we're going to remove a player from the pitch. If we can walk a player off, we always walk a player off. If we have to regress to putting them on a stretcher, then we'll regress to putting them on a stretcher. But it comes down to those communication skills. And then it comes down to setting up the environment. And if the players know their roles and responsibilities when it comes to injury, i.e. being a very, very good historian, being very clear with their instructions when it comes to decisions that need to be made within, you know, I guess 180 seconds, really. Like, I mean, the rules have changed within the game now, whereas if there's a suspected head injury, then the referees are giving you a little bit more time. But until that change had come in, you had to make a decision within 60 seconds. So if players weren't communicating with you and you didn't have that ability to kind of focus them, eyeball them and understand what was going on, so that if you did need to make a change, that the management, you were radioing through to the sideline and the management could start preparing for that. Because the moment you run out onto that pitch, even before I got to the player, all I would hear in my ear is he going to continue? Is he able to play on? And my words were, I am assessing him as it is right now. I will let you know as soon as I know. Trying to kind of again communicate that story along. Paulina, if you were in that situation, and the manager asked you to get Francie back, I'm not asking you to tell what the story is, right? And you sent the player home, and you couldn't get in touch with the player, and you had to knock on the manager's door a second time, what would you say to him? You don't have his phone number, and you can't get in touch with him.
Well, I would just need to say it's truth. You know what I mean? Like, what else can you do? So you need to go, just say exactly what happened, try and maybe improve the communication, because there was no agreement in between them two in regards to what happens when the players get injured, what's the expectation of the manager. And I think that would be the best moment to actually try and gather that and say, look, I'm really sorry this happened. I sent him home. I didn't know you'd want to see him. Like, you know, you just need to explain the situation. I think it's not a blame game of who's done a mistake here. It's just a miscommunication. And, you know, if he does get angry, like, what can you do? If he just says, okay, let's talk this through, that's brilliant. But at least you've made some steps to try and improve it. And I think just in regards to the questions that you asked to Steph and Vali, I think that Pepper was just trying to please everyone there. And that was the biggest problem. She was trying to please Francie, but just like, you know, he was just like, can you look at it? And, you know, and she jumped ships and she was trying to do the hands-on assessment, skipping the steps. She was trying to find out the answer for the manager, but, you know, realistically, the injury just happened. Like, was this objective assessment going to be successful enough for her to, you know, to predict the degree of the injury at this stage? Or should she just stepped back and say, look, I'm not trying to please anyone here today. We just need to manage it as an acute, you know, complete the acute management phase, and then we'll need to return to it either tomorrow morning or a day after, because that's going to give me a better understanding of what's happening. So I think that it was just kind of like, it's my first day on the job. I'm trying to please everyone, and it's just gone wrong.
Brilliant. I think coming back to Mr. Marsh's point on the team communications, you make a good point there, Paulina. Mr. Marsh, have you been involved in these discussions with managers and return to play or injured decision making?
Most of it tends to be done with the physios. I think we always copy the managers in on the communications and the operation reports and so on, so they know what's going on. But most of the discussions I have will be with the physios. And I say one of the important things is that they come with the player when I see them. And I do encourage them to come and watch the operation as well. Most physios have been and seen operations before. It's not a problem. So that they come and watch, they can see exactly what's gone wrong and how it's fixed. And my point on this would be that the club has a responsibility to Francie. Now, he's injured under their care. And it is an injury, if they manage it badly, that could affect his career. So I think actually they do have responsibility to get him back, to properly assess him and work out what they need to do to try and get the injury better. So I would suggest that they've done the right thing, because they have a responsibility to protect him and to get him back to fitness so he can, with a bit of luck, go and achieve his goals.
Fantastic. Well, the cliffhanger that I'm going to leave you on before we hand over to Stel, and Stel may like to elaborate on this, is that Pepper is on her first day. She's on the verge of losing her job at this stage, because she's just not performed very well, carried out a very, very poor subjective, an even worse physical examination. The player has gone home. The manager is going mental. The player also has a mental health issue, which we haven't really discussed on this podcast. And I don't want to discuss on the podcast, because I want to urge all of you to go to 108 Harley Street, go to the SEM part, and You can read chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3 is in Premier Injuries, and chapter 4, which will be coming out the day after tomorrow, will be on our Harley Street website. And I promise you, you might not actually predict how this chapter is going to finish. So, Stel, your thoughts?
Wow. A lot to take in there, but no, I'm very excited to see where this story is going to go. As you said earlier, Ben and I worked on chapter 3 and we saw the introduction of the gaffer, and he had a little bit of a cameo in this chapter as well, didn't he? So yeah, it's a storyline, we can say the plot thickens on each chapter.
Well, he's got to see Mr. Marsh in a couple of chapters' time, so but I, you know, this chapter might not end the way you may think it would end, but I will leave it on that. Has anybody else got anything they would like to say before Stel wraps up this amazing podcast session tonight?
I'd just like to thank Simon for jumping on, joining us, and being on the show for close to an hour and 20 minutes. So, yeah, thanks for your time.
Yeah, it does. Way past my bedtime. Crikey, come on. the important thing is that we get people together from the different aspects of how we treat these people, so we can all chat, get the right diagnosis, get the right treatment, all work together to get people back to the sport they love doing. And as, you know, we've made the point time and time again, it's the team approach, it's the communication, it's everybody mucking in together to make sure we get it right.
Fantastic.
Brilliant. So let's wrap this up, ladies and gentlemen. Again, another fantastic episode. Twitter handles and all the good stuff. Johnny, when is the actual articles going to be released? You say day after tomorrow, right?
Yes, I hand over the finished product to Tina Da Costa in Harley Street tomorrow. Then she has about 24 hours work on it. And then it goes live in 48 hours' time. So very exciting stuff. So it gives the readers an opportunity to read chapter 1, 2, and 3 as well, and a little bit on the background of how we are telling, you know, presenting sport and exercise medicine through groin injury in an exciting adventure story and something that people can really relate to. So, that's when that's coming out.
Fantastic. So let's wrap this up with socials. Johnny.
Johnny_Wilson5, or you can catch me on 108sem.co.uk. So if you've got any queries there, make sure you head over to our website on Harley Street.
Nottingham Physio.
And Nottingham Physio as well, for sure. But I'll leave that to Paulina. Paulina's the director there, so I don't want to take her steal her show, steal her thunder.
Go on, director lady.
So, my Twitter name is Paulina0295. And if you want to get in touch as well, check out our website at nottinghamphysio.com.
Great stuff. Fally.
Yeah, you can connect via Twitter. It's Fally Vidarsson. Be happy to connect with anyone and answer any questions.
Fantastic. Steph?
Yes, my Twitter is stephanie.rozowski. If any questions about the chapters coming up and or any questions about sports physio or anything in particular, I'll be happy to help.
Brilliant. And Mr. Marsh, are you on social media? Are you steering well clear of that realm?
Do you know, I do tweet now and again. The best way to get all the details is just go to the Harley Street website, 108harleystreet.co.uk, and you'll find all the details there, the emails, phone numbers, the Twittery bits, all be there for you.
Brilliant. Wonderful. And that's it for another episode. Hope you guys have enjoyed this one. I sure as have. So, give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot Defence. We've got an Instagram account as well, which we're quite busy on, to be fair. So that's it. Until next month, take care, ladies and gents.